I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. This is Itzhak Perlman's exquisite vibrato on Bach's first violin sonata. He was mature by the time he made this recording, 30 years into a career that started before his bar mitzvah. Perlman doesn't like the word prodigy, but it's hard to avoid. At 3, he was practicing scales on a toy violin. At 4, he was studying with a great master. At 13, he was whisked away from his native Israel to the United States to be on the Ed Sullivan Show. He won admission to Juilliard that same year. From prodigy to master, and finally national treasure, for 60 years, his life was a blur of world tours and TV specials, playing for the Queen and given a place of honor on the program for Obama's inauguration. Yet Itzhak Perlman had a difficult childhood. Stricken by polio in the war-torn early days of Israeli statehood, now he gives back at every opportunity, including through the Perlman Music Program. Founded by his wife Toby, the summer school is located on idyllic Shelter Island, giving talented kids of every background the chance to study with the world's greatest musicians. You'll meet Toby and a couple of former students at the end of the program. You'll even hear the students play a virtuoso movement from Mendelssohn's Octet. The whole crew join me live on stage at the NYU Skirball Center in Greenwich Village.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's Itzhak Perlman.
Now, before we get into the real grist here, you
grist.
And I were talking backstage.
What is grist?
The grist, you know, the real essence of it.
Grist. I like that.
So this is a burning question I have. What's your favorite guilty pleasure go-to food or snack late at night?
Oh, late at night. Now that I'm old, there's no food after 8 o'clock. You know, if I pay for it,
you can't eat after eight o'clock.
I can eat it, but then in the middle of the night, oh, Gewalt.
Gewalt.
So no food.
But you grew up.
Food was everything.
Food was everything.
Yeah.
Very, very guiding force in your life because you grew up kind of poor, correct?
Very.
No. What did your dad do? You grew up in Tel Aviv.
Yes.
And what was your father? What was his occupation?
Well, my father did all sorts of things. You know, he was, he immigrated from Poland to Israel, you know, and no profession really. So he picked oranges in an orchard. He went into construction. Anything, he just got any job. He was not, you know, he did not have a particular skill. So he just did whatever it is and he learned on the job. And then when he met my mother, they somehow got a hold of a barber shop and she knew how to cut hair, but she taught him how to do that. So he did that as well. So he did like everything that he had to do to make a living.
How many siblings did you have?
I'm an only child.
Only child?
Yes.
I always ask people who have a career similar to your career, if you understood...
They have careers similar to my career?
Well, not really. Actually, no.
Really?
There aren't many. But anybody who was a young person, who, especially in this world you're in, where they cultivate them very young, and in sports, too, where they get these kids when they're 10 years old, and they kind of know that they're heading to the NBA or the NFL or whatever. But you're a very young child, and I'm wondering... Do you know what you're going through when you're a young child, or you're too busy doing it to understand what you're inside of when you're getting shot through this rocket to become this famous?
Well, when I was young, my parents thought that I had a good ear because I could repeat everything, you know, by singing it. And then I said I want to play the violin, and I think they told me that I had a nice sound. So that was the, if you want to call it the unusual thing about the way I played, I had a nice sound.
You were playing on what? Didn't you have like a toy violin? Or
well, I just started with a toy, which I didn't like, so I quit that. And then I was playing on something. I don't remember what it was. It wasn't anything spectacular.
How old were you?
I started really when I was like almost four and three quarters, almost 5 years old.
Do you know why? What made you do that?
I wanted. I liked the sound. I loved the sound of the violin. I heard it on the radio. And I said, that's what I want to do. Simple. That's what I want to do. And there is no explanation. You know, everybody has a different thing that they hear, and it sort of grabs their imagination.
Yeah.
And the violin sound was that. And I think it was Heifetz, so he was pretty good for grabbing the imagination, you know?
Well, when I was a kid, I saw Butch Cassidy, and I said, that's what I want to do. I want to rob trains. Very impressionable when we're young. But when you're 5 years old, what's the difference between when you teach a 5-year-old and a 10-year-old?
I don't teach that young. You know, there are people who specialize. And then you can tell, basically, something about technique, you know, something about what kind of hands do they have. You know, it reminds me sometimes, you know, you see young baseball players, you know, and they say they've got soft hands, you know, when they catch the ball, that's soft hands. Well, something like this is similar. When you play, you can see that somebody can get around the violin pretty naturally, even though it's not finished or anything like this. But at an early age, you can already see it. So that gives you an inclination as to what's in the future. But of course, you don't know what's in the future. You just, and for me, I personally feel that when I hear somebody play at a young age, let's say even 10, 11, 12 years old, if they play age appropriately, I'm very happy. What I mean by age appropriate is that you can, if you close your eyes, you think that's a young person. You know, there is hope. There is, you know, there is talent there, and but it's young. You hear it, as opposed to listening to sometimes if you put on the internet, you know, you hear people who are 5, 6, 7 years old who sounds like they're 25 years old. You know, like amazing, and that I find sometimes is challenging, because if you're 12 and you sound like you're 25, what are you going to sound like when you're 18 or 19? You know, that's I worry about. Because that's very, very difficult.
They come along too quickly.
Exactly. You know, and how do you teach this person?
Okay, and according to your philosophy, at what age do you start to get a little tougher with them when they're how old?
Well, it's not a question of being tough. It's
word you use.
Well, look, everybody has their own sort of schedule of development. You know, sometimes you hear somebody at the age of 12 who just sound basic, not very, very good. But you hear something there. And so you have to know what to say and what not to say. I'd like to just insert that. You know, what's the great secret of a good teacher is not only knowing what to say, but knowing what not to say. And especially what not to say when somebody that has great gift and great musical naturalness.
And those that have that great gift and that natural
ability.
You
leave them alone.
You do.
You leave them alone.
You don't want to hurt their feelings.
No, you don't want to hurt them. No, it's not their feelings. It's you don't want to futz around. You know, you don't want to, you know, just let the natural ability, the natural talent develop. And usually things get better as you grow older, you know, without having to really nitpick with everything. And that's I find is a danger, because you know, when a teacher has such incredible talent in front of them, you know, they want to give you their all, so then they become too picky. Leave it alone. Just leave it alone.
During what years did you study with Goldgart?
I studied with her from the age of 5 until I was 13.
You studied with her for 8 years.
8 years.
And then you came to the United States,
right,
to do Sullivan when you were 13 years old.
Yes.
Now when you came to do Sullivan, I find that unbelievable. When you came to do Sullivan and you're 13 years old,
yes,
did you have any idea who Sullivan was? This was your first
absolutely
trip to the U.S.
Not.
I had no idea.
I
was some weird
no
guy
idea
with like you shoe know, polish in his hair.
Exactly. No, yeah. I didn't know how he looked or anything. I just in Israel, they talked about, because when we came to Israel to audition a whole bunch of people to go on his show, they said there they didn't call him Sullivan. They called him Sullivan.
Sullivan.
Ed Sullivan. Heard of Ed Sullivan. Who is Ed Sullivan? I don't know Ed Sullivan. Oh, television. Oh, my. Oh, I said, okay, television. I said, the minute I heard television, said, I'm in. So I auditioned, you know, and then I was chosen. You know, there was
sent people over to audition musicians,
yes,
in Israel for
Sullivan?
Yes, because Sullivan?
He wanted, Ed Sullivan wanted a show only of the Israeli, pardon my accent, only of the Israeli people. So it was a variety.
He was a great Jew, Ed Sullivan, wasn't he?
Yes.
Going back to the homeland, bringing the kids over.
Well, there some people thought his name was Ed Solomon, but we changed it to Ed Sullivan.
It might have been.
But you know, so the whole show was an Israeli variety show. You've seen this show. You know, he had everybody. He had a monkey dancing, and then he had somebody playing the violin and so on. In this particular case, it was a pair of folk singers, and there was
Topo GGO.
We didn't have Topo, and no, we didn't Topo have then. GGO. Okay. We didn't have them, but we had a ballet dancer who was 14. We had a coloratura soprano from Yemen. I think I was in the department of human interest story or chubby story. I don't know what I was, but I was cute, I think. Sort of.
You were very cute.
I was cute. Thank you so much.
Oh my
Thank
God,
you.
You were so cute. I've
Thank
seen
you.
The footage.
I know. I
so
was
so cute.
So
when you
so
come
cute.
Over, you'd never been to the U.S. before.
No.
Your mother comes with you.
Yes.
And you perform on Sullivan.
Yes.
Do you remember what that was like doing the show?
It was slightly exciting. I didn't know. No, it was very exciting, you know. And so I kind of played, and it was over very quickly, you know, because I did the last movement of the Mendelssohn Concerto, and they cut it down to about, I think, 2 minutes and 45 seconds, because that was it. And he introduced me. He was a lovely gentleman, really very, very nice.
And then what happened after you did Sullivan?
We went on a tour.
In the U.S.,
the entire group that did Sullivan, we went on a tour.
For how long? Months? For,
yeah, about three or four months.
Around
you know?
The country?
Yeah, yeah.
And at the end of that tour?
And at the end of the tour, the main thing, the challenge was to get into the Juilliard School. And that was one of doing it.
Was that a plan for you to go to Juilliard?
Yes.
When you were back in Israel before Sullivan? That had always been in your sights?
Before Sullivan, it was a dream to go to Juilliard, but Sullivan made it.
But you were aware of Juilliard.
Yes, right. I was aware of Juilliard, and there was a teacher there who taught Juilliard that I heard about in Israel by the name of Galamian. And so we said, one of these days, maybe you'll study with
Galamian.
Him. Galamian. Yeah. Ivan Galamian, yeah.
Yes.
His assistant at that time was Dorothy DeLay, and she came and heard me play. And she thought that I had a good chance.
You had a good sound.
I had a good sound, you know. That was my forte, is the sound.
By then you were how old? 13.
No, 13 and a half, 14,
so
yeah.
So right around the same Sullivan period.
Yeah.
So what was it like for you? You'd never lived in New York. I mean, again, this idea of being like shot out of a cannon to have this spectacular career, this big ticket career. You're 13 years old. You're on Sullivan. You're touring the country. You're going to go to Juilliard. What was your recollection of that? Was it intimidating, or you don't have time to think about that?
I didn't really think about it because it wasn't really... look, it wasn't like a professional career. It was a specialized career, you know. In other words, to play for it was an Ed Sullivan concert. It wasn't like I was playing a recital someplace, you know, or I was making my debut in Carnegie Hall or anything like that. It was a specialized kind of concert, you know. And I used to play for Jewish benefits, you know, for the UJ. And they knew about me, you know, because the whole organization, the Jewish organization, knew about this Sullivan program. So they used some of the people for fundraising. And I was, you know, sometimes I would be called at the telephone. I would be hired to do 15 minutes or 10 minutes at the end of the fundraising, you know. And I would appear probably like 11 o'clock at night. You know, and I would play the Nigun by Bloch and the Flight of the Bumblebee, and that was it. And then I would leave, and I would get paid, you know, and it was great. You know, I played while the people were eating their desserts and of kosher food and things like that.
So. And was it the same people? Like one night you do Flight of the Bumblebee, and somebody says, he was better at Jerry's bar mitzvah. So much better.
I never did bar mitzvahs.
No, you didn't.
I never did bar mitzvahs, and I didn't
just
do
UJA.
And I didn't do weddings.
No weddings?
No weddings. Absolutely, you know.
Now, when you leave and you come to the United States, when you left for the Sullivan trip, was it assumed you were going to go home, or did you kind of know?
No.
You knew you weren't going home.
No. I knew that I was going to stay.
You were going back.
I was going to stay.
Really?
And,
what happened? Where'd your dad go?
My dad stayed for about a year in Israel and finished selling the apartment and doing the business, and then he came and joined us. Yeah, I even remember, you know, I did not see my dad for a year. And the only way to get in touch was through letters. And then a bit later on, you know, maybe, after about 5, 6, 7, 8 months, we actually were able to arrange for a long distance call from New York to Tel Aviv, you know, and at that time, so you're talking about 1958, 59. So it was like 10 o'clock in the morning, you know, and the phone rings and I thought, hello. I said, hello? And that was the connection. You know, that was the connection. And, you know, we had...
I'm going to cry.
Absolutely. And we had in our street where I lived, we had no phone. So what we had was there was a grocery store that had a telephone. So whoever wanted to make a long-distance call would go to the grocery store and we'd pick up. So that's what it
but
was.
But you knew you were going to stay.
Yes, yes. I learned the language from watching TV and, you know, listening to Yankee baseball.
You spoke very little English.
Well, no. No, hardly. I took a class of English in Israel. I think I failed. But it's amazing how quickly you learn, you know, when you hear the language around you all the time.
And you went to Juilliard, what, for how many years?
Let's see. Until, I think, 19 or... I was 19 or 20, I think.
For 4 years.
Because I remember still... doing concerts and having to go to class. And, you know, sometimes I was late to a class and I got hell to pay, you know, because I just took a flight from Los Angeles. Give me a break, you know. So, no, but you didn't go to English class. You know, you have to be there. So, but I was, you know, I did both things for a while. And then I graduated.
And is it literally your hand and your brain, the way they connect? Or is it a passion and a spirit that you have inside you also that helps you play the violin the way that you do?
When you talk about having a good sound, what does that mean, having a good sound? It means that you play the violin and you hear a particular sound and that's you. It's something that's individual. That's all it is. It's not like I'm not going to practice so that I'm going to get a good sound. I'm talking about the tone, actually, the tone, which deals with the beauty of the sound. Sound, of course, is technical. My teachers worked on it, you know, how you use the bow, you know, where you put the bow between the strings and you know, what's the direction of the bow speed, et cetera, et cetera. It's a healthy sound. But the beauty of the tone is something that every person has differently. It's an individual
thing. They
gotta
bring what they bring.
Yeah, you cannot teach that. There's certain things you cannot teach.
And where do you think your sound comes from?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. It's something that I hear.
You had polio when you're how old?
I had polio when I was 4¾.
Do you find that music become, you imbue that with even more of your being and your spirit because you were limited in the things you could do as a child?
I don't think so.
I'm getting everything wrong with you, aren't I?
Everything.
But it's going, good. No, that's not it. No.
But you're batting a
Actually,
thousand.
No.
That's good.
No.
But you're doing good. You know, I mean,
No, seriously, I
don't think so. I mean, I couldn't say to you, well, let me see how I'm playing without the polio, and now let's see how I'm playing with the polio. I can't say that.
But I'm wondering if you that okay.
Sorry, I'm giving you such a hard time, so I'm so sorry.
No, I mean, I knew this was coming. I've been around you a few times. It's always an obstacle course. But anyway, but no, what I'm saying is that do you think the spirit of the person, is that relevant? No.
I don't know. I love to watch people who are famous, like whether they're actors or people in sports, and sort of try and guess what kind of people they are in private, you know, and being good and being a wonderful person and being a sort of an agreeable, simpatico kind of person is not necessarily together. You know, I remember my wife always, you know, sometimes we go to a concert and we hear somebody who is absolutely amazing. And I say, Toby, come on, let's go backstage and say hello. And she says, I'd rather not. You know, I don't want to be disappointed. I love the way this person plays.
Let's
not do it. Let me just relax and just enjoy it.
Many people who conduct, and I'd love to get your opinion of this, many people who conduct are people who have good careers as a soloist. They play typically the violin or the piano. But they don't necessarily have great careers. But someone taps them on the shoulder and says, oh, you keep time very well, and they move them on. No, but I mean, every one of them I would talk to would say that to me. I'd say, Dutoit, this one. They'd say, somebody walked up to me when I was like 10 years old and said, you keep time very well. Yeah. And they moved them into the conducting program, what have you.
I thought they moved into the viola section. I mean,
That's our ad for the show, right?
No. I must tell you that viola jokes are no longer applicable because the level of viola playing has really risen, seriously. So that you said,
what do you attribute that to?
No, it's really viola jokes. You know, it used to be that the level was a little bit below, but right now it's brilliant. I mean, so many brilliant viola players. Wow. So that it's not, but it's still funny, you know. So.
Violin legend Itzhak Perlman has a special place in his heart for the New York Philharmonic. He and then music director Alan Gilbert teamed up for the Phil's opening gala a few years ago.
Here comes our guest soloist, Itzhak Perlman, followed by music director of the New York Philharmonic, Alan Gilbert.
Gilbert found out he got the job from the Phil's president, Zarin Mehta, after a particularly miserable bedtime for his toddlers.
We had had a torturous night, and they'd finally fallen asleep, and I got a call from Zarin Mehta just after they had fallen asleep. And he said, I'd like to invite you to be our next music director. And I said, my kids just fell asleep. I can't talk to you now. But
oh my
then I called him back, and we had a
I want to put that scene in a movie where a guy's like, more than being the music director of the Philharmonic, I want my kids to go to sleep.
Yeah,
click.
Totally.
We all know the madness of that moment.
Yeah.
The rest of my conversation with conductor Alan Gilbert at heresthething.org. Coming up, Itzhak Perlman on Alan and Gilbert's art, what makes a great conductor, plus his wife Toby Perlman on their music school, and the next generation of great masters takes on Mendelssohn and my questions. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Itzhak Perlman didn't bring his famous Stradivarius. He says playing takes more effort now than it used to.
As you get older, everything becomes more difficult and more demanding.
And, really?
Oh, are you kidding me? but, you know, if you do a great piece, you can do it over and over again. Right. And no matter how, I mean, for me, I mean, a perfect example is the Beethoven Violin Concerto, which is not getting any easier as you get older. But it's very, very difficult when you're young as well.
It's tough.
I call it, when my students start the piece, I say, welcome to the lifetime journey. Because right. That's what it is. You know, you start to play and it's pretty good. And then you play it again, and you play it again, and you just grow up with it. So that's what music is about. And the minute you think musically like that, especially when you repeat something, you're on the right track. Instead of saying, oh, I have to do that again. No, but, you know, you have to look at the music, and you have to say, this is going to be yet another experience. You know, it's going to be one way or another way, but it's not going to be a repetition of what I did a week ago or a month ago.
When you want to sit down, assuming that you do this, I don't want to assume, but when you want to listen to someone else play the violin that you admire and you admire their sound, give us an example of somebody you listen to. Who's a violinist you love?
For pure tone, the first person that comes to mind is Fritz Kreisler. You know, you listen to old recordings of hymns, and you think, you know, those days, there wasn't the great advancement in technology and so on. It's that you hear scratches, you hear the tone, and you say, oh my God, that is something unbelievable. You know, or, you know, Menuhin had a fantastic sound. I mean, everybody had a different kind of sound, but sometimes sounds, it's apples and oranges, you know. I mean, but that the first person that I hear of that kind of sound is his. But you can say, hello.
This is a very dear friend of mine, by the way. Yeah. You should be ashamed of yourself.
I thought
Do you know
was...
that story about the Mahler 9 with Alan at Lincoln Center? And they get down to the end. I mean, talk about squeezing it to death. I mean, they're squeezing the end of the Mahler 9. It's like... It's like this cosmic soup. And the guy's phone goes off. And he's sitting there going... And no one in his office told him he had a new phone.
And oh, that's
his
right. And you can't.
Set the
and
phone
you cannot close
and they put
it,
an alarm
it.
On it.
Yeah.
And the alarm. And finally, Alan stops the performance. They stopped the end of the Mahler 9.
So that was a very special Mahler 9.
That was a memorable.
It was
talk
like
about squeezing it.
Yes, it was like a sausage. It had two endings.
Now tell me. Now, you conduct.
Yes.
And when did that begin and why?
It began, I'll tell you, it's very funny. It began with the Perlman Music Program. My wife, who started this whole thing, she said to me, we're going to have a string orchestra. Could you coach them? So I didn't think of myself as a conductor. I thought of myself as a coach. So I picked up a pencil and conducted with a pencil, you know, because if you conduct with a baton, you're a conductor. With a pencil, you're more of a teacher. You see that thing? And anyway, so that's actually when it started. And I got some interesting, again, I got some nice sounds from the orchestra. Conducting, I find very mysterious, you know, because you can have four or five conductors who are absolutely excellent, and each one gives you a downbeat, and the orchestra will sound different with each one.
What do you attribute that to?
I have no idea, thank God.
What do you think makes a good conductor?
Oh, well, obviously knowing the score and knowing all of this thing. But in the final analysis, there is a mystery as to what makes somebody conduct a phrase and the orchestra play a certain way.
I don't understand
that. You know, a great conductor should understand what he or she wants to hear from the orchestra. So if I do, let's say, a Beethoven or a Brahms symphony, what do you say to a great orchestra who have performed that hundreds of times?
Right.
How do you get the orchestra to hear pa 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 and say, hey, that's really good stuff? as opposed to again. You know, so that's the
four
difference.
Four notes for crying out.
Well, it's my own rendition of what I want to hear.
So if you say to me, it's Haitink doing this Mahler piece, he right. paces it up, which I don't like.
Right.
And if you show me that it's Gergiev, he squeezes every drop out of it. How could one movement be almost 2 minutes longer with someone else conducting?
Easily.
And it's easily. I mean, they just squeeze it. And
yeah,
I like it
but also,
squeezed.
But also, if it's too slow, it doesn't mean that it's bad. And if it's too fast, it doesn't mean that it's bad. If it works, there is no such thing as the right tempo. If you hear that it's too fast, then maybe there's something in your background that you're not used to it.
Now, tell everybody the idea. How did the school start?
It was Toby's idea, my wife Toby's idea. It was her dream because we met in a school, in a summer program.
During Juilliard?
During Juilliard, sure, of course. And so she started this whole thing, you know, and it was actually 25 years ago. So this is our 25th anniversary for the Perlman Music Program. And yes. And it was basically for strings. And I think we had kids come to our house in Long Island and practice scales. And, you know, like at 8 o'clock in the morning, you said, Toby thought that was the greatest alarm clock. But we're now in Shelter Island.
Right. Now, the people, whether it's the young program or the 18 and over program, is it free of charge and you're raising money to pay for the whole people?
We never refuse for lack of funds. We give a lot of people scholarships and some... some more, some less, and so on. And some, if they want to pay, they can pay. But it really doesn't matter because, you know, the expense of the program is so that even if we were to charge everybody equally, we'll still be in the red severely, severely, believe me, severely. But it's great. And the program has not grown on purpose. Right. You know, we started with about 38, 39 kids, and we still have 38, 39 kids for the Littles program. And it's amazing. It's very difficult to describe unless you
it
go
is.
There
yeah.
and just well, give the experience. We have kids playing twice a week, works in progress. We call it WIPs, you know, where they try new pieces in front of an audience and so on. It's great. And I've been, during the summers, I don't play concerts. I just teach there.
Yeah.
And with other great, great faculty. And we have, you know, the philosophy of a lack, once you're in that program, a lack of competition between the kids. You know, they all support each other. And for me, that's so important, you know, that you know, when somebody plays well, they're truly happy for them. And when somebody messes up, they go and they console them, and they really feel for them. It's a real family.
Yeah,
it's so important.
It's a great vibe. Itzhak Perlman's wife, Toby Perlman, please come and join us, Toby. And please welcome Rachel Lee Pryde and Randall Goosby.
Thank you.
Toby.
Yeah.
Your husband has so kindly dumped the responsibility of explaining to her all about the school to you. So how did it start?
I want to say something else first.
Go right ahead.
I want to say something about the sound. He doesn't know. It's like breathing. You don't think about each breath that you take. You just do it. And I breathe a little differently than you. The sound that he makes comes from, I don't know, magic or something that I don't understand. Unique to him. And that's the only kind of sound he can make.
I'm stuck with it.
Right. So, okay, now ask me a question.
I love that. I believe that. I believe in something otherworldly inside you. But so the school started when?
25 years ago, the school started. It started because I went to a meeting. I was invited to a meeting out in the Hamptons. People wanted to start a music festival. I wasn't really interested at all. And I said that up front, but I went, and there was talk, and somebody said, and we could have a school. And I said, oh, I could do that. I'd like to do that. And that was maybe March, and in August, we ran a two-week program.
And where did you run the program initially?
We ran it at Boys Harbor. Do you
sure.
know, you know where
yep.
that is?
Yep,
and
of course.
They had snakes in the rooms, and there was no hall to play in.
So it was exciting.
The dining room was the concert hall, and yeah, it was very exciting.
Yeah.
We
yeah.
also had the food. Should we talk about the food?
No.
What food did you serve in the early days of the school?
Mystery meats.
Mystery meats. Now, for Rachel, now you are not at the school anymore. You went to the school, correct?
Yeah, I went to the Perlman Music Program beginning in 2001.
Right. And how many summers were you there?
I was there at the Littles program for 6 years, and then I went to the Chamber Workshop, and I also attended their Sarasota Winter Program.
How old were you when you knew you had a little special something in the musical department? How old were you?
Well, so I actually asked for a violin for my fourth birthday. I saw it on TV on Lamb Chop's Play Along, and
and then what happened?
The day rolled around, and I had sort of forgotten about it, but in the middle of the day, I think in the afternoon or something, I suddenly remembered, and then I was like, where's my violin? And I got really upset, and I started crying, and then I think my mom knew I was really serious about it. So when I was about 4 and a half, she finally got me one.
What about you?
I started a little bit older, when I was 7.
Father time over here.
Yeah. My mother is Korean, and she grew up in Japan, and music education is a very big part of their culture, and so she wanted me to have music, and for some random reason, I chose violin.
You're going to school where now?
At Juilliard now.
You're at Juilliard now. And you talk about Perlman, how nurturing it is, and how it's like a family. Would you say that Juilliard's the same way?
Or is it a little more? Who told you to ask me that?
Juilliard's a little more competitive.
It's safe to say, yeah, a little bit. But most of the people I hang out with at Juilliard I met at PMP. So I still have my sort of family.
You got out of that.
Yeah, that worked out well.
And he said what he said about making a certain sound. Do you feel that you have a sound? Are you developing
your sound?
I guess
by Mrs. P's definition, yes.
Right.
Like Mrs. P said, it's kind of second nature. It's like breathing. So we kind of focus on the difficult stuff.
I disagree. You have to work on your sound. I mean, I think all our video nights and studio class really, you know, nailed that in my head that you need to work on your sound.
And what's the goal for you? What do you want to do?
What do I want to do? Yeah. Well, for me, I love solo playing. I love working with recital partners, with pianists, and I love chamber music, and I also love teaching. So for me, having a variety of activities really is the most satisfying.
How have, would you say, for both of you, how have the students changed who were coming through the program in the 25 years you've been doing it?
I can tell you that in terms of applicants and admissions, the level is higher and higher and higher and higher.
Right.
It's like everything else. The kids throw a ball faster and hit the tennis ball faster and run faster and swim faster and play faster and better.
Right. Amazing. Now, we're going to bring out six other people who've been playing the violin since they were 18 months old. Let's get them out here. And then when we're done performing, we're going to end. We're going to end with this music. Here they come. Great.
Thank you.
That was Itzhak Perlman, his wife and Perlman Music Program founder Toby, and their brilliant violin students Rachel Lee Priday and Randall Gooseby. The artists who made up the octet were Rachel and Randall, plus Stella Chen and Kenneth Renshaw also on violin, Chaley Smith and Joshua Kale on viola, Nico Olarte Hayes and Ichun Su on cello. The piece was the Presto from Mendelssohn's Octet Opus 20 in E-flat major, recorded live at NYU's Skirball Center in Manhattan. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.